Hi, I'm Chris Berube. Today on Focus, it's summer, which means that kids are going to have a lot more free time on their hands. More and more, children are filling that time by sitting in front of a screen. But how much screen time is okay? How much is healthy or even ethical? Screens are becoming harder to avoid, and many researchers are arguing that putting a kid in front of a good app on an iPad might be helpful for them. But are they bad for kids' attention? We'll be joined by Hanna Rosen, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and David Bickham, a staff scientist at the Center on Media and Child Health. We'll talk about screens, educational media, and how much is too much. I'm Chris Berube. That's coming up today on Focus on AM 580 after the news. You're listening to Focus on WYLL. I'm Chris Berube. Well, many children are now on summer vacation, and parents are faced with the annual question, what am I going to do with my kids for all this time? It's easier than ever to put a child in front of a screen, especially with apps. There are now 40,000 kids' games available in iTunes, plus thousands more through Google Play. Today on Focus, we're discussing screen time, educational media, and the question of how much is too much. Joining us on the program today is Hanna Rosen. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic and at Double X at Slate Magazine. Hello, Hanna. Hanna's joining us today from Washington. Also on the line, we have David Bickham, a research scientist at the Center on Media and Child Health at Children's Hospital Boston and an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Good morning.
Hi, David. I'm David. Hi, Chris.
You're David, yes. I'm glad we could sort that out before we get going.
Got to take care of that right away.
Good. Now that we've established who's who, Hanna, we're talking about this today because of an article that you wrote that was the cover of The Atlantic on the April issue regarding children and screen time. It seems like we're at this real cultural moment where touch screens are becoming, this worry point for parents. Why is it sort of hit an apex right now?
I think it's because they're now so ubiquitous. The television worked in a slightly different way in my household and probably many people's households, which is my children would not dream of just going and turning on the television without asking me. It's big, it's there in the middle of the living room. But if you have a phone or an iPad, it works on an entirely different principle. It's there. It's just, there with your keys and the toys. It's just kind of part of the house. And so they always feel like they have access to it. And then you have this extra thing that toddlers can instinctively figure out, particularly an iPad, because it's such a big screen with very little help. Different from a mouse, which takes a kind of conceptual leap because you have to explain to a child, hold the mouse, that connects with what you're seeing on the screen, but they don't really need any kind of instruction, so it makes them feel a sense of greater ownership over what's happening on the screen.
Yeah, it does feel like with the advent of all of these apps that really it's just so much more intuitive for a kid than it ever was before.
Yeah, I mean, if you parents with toddlers, I've got these two sets of kids, ones who are slightly older and one who was born pretty much exactly contemporaneous with the iPad. I did not have to teach the kid anything. I mean, he just watched his brother one single time when he was in diapers. I mean, seeing a kid in diapers playing with an iPad or a phone is kind of an eerie experience. It gives you the sense that they're a generation wired completely differently, whatever that means. I'm speaking in loose layman language there, but just that something is different about the way they interact with this stuff than the way that other generations have.
Hanna, you have had this experience pretty firsthand, in part because you have small children who've kind of been interacting with this technology, right?
Yes, and I have one very young child who, as I said, just picked up the iPad and started playing with it by himself.
So, David, are we seeing statistics that are verifying that children are spending more time on screens than before?
Research travels much slower than the use of these media. So we're always a little bit a step behind, especially when something is changing so quickly. The iPad is just so new. But the data that we do have has shown that, one of the key points is that televisions are still really prevalent. They're still very much present in our children's rooms. Kids, about a third of kids under two have a TV set in their room. So it's still pretty much the medium of choice. But what we have seen recently is that exposure to TV content has stayed pretty much the same, or actually increased a little bit, but where young people are going for that content has really begun to shift from the static, stable television screen to more online choices. And even that data is a few years old and was before it was so easy to access television-type content on tablets. So that's kind of what we know at the moment. But as the research continues, we should learn more and more about how these young children, how much time they're spending using these devices.
I'm not sure which one of you wants to handle this, but it almost seems to me from some parents I know that screen time, that isn't television has become additive. As in, once you get the iPad, if there's a sense that there are, educational purposes to some of these games, they replace toys in the rotation as opposed to just replacing television in a child's life.
It's different in every family. I mean, one of the things that I tried to do with the story, because I feel like we're stuck in this neurotic moment where we have a sense that this stuff is all poison, we don't know what to do with it, we kind of give it to our kids, just to get through a dinner or to get through a day, instead of embracing it and thinking hard about what are the good parts of it, So as I've talked about this story, I've realized that every family has different rules. Some families read my story and they say, well, look, we still have strict limits. And I think that's fine. If you decide your kid can only do half an hour a day or the iPad is replacing the television, that's all fine. What I'm trying to get people to shift is their attitude, for people to actually think about what the research shows about how some of this interactivity that kids have with games is actually pretty good and how it's good, and to embrace it at some level, and then, think about what you want to do with your own kid. But a lot of the research does show that children get a lot more out of screen interaction when it's interactive, as opposed to, say, statically watching TV.
Yeah, it's interesting because with television, it's always been the educational TV has always come from sort of well-established places that have, like Sesame Workshop, that has a fantastic system for determining the effectiveness of the content. So you've always been pretty confident that it's worked. Because it's required, we sort of require that because the kid doesn't have that interactivity. So it has to be something that's being delivered effectively and that is only really used in one way, receiving it. But with these apps, when you're giving a kid a free play opportunity, this sort of definition of education becomes very different. You're not just sort of teaching them letters and numbers, but you're giving them the opportunity to learn and explore the same way that they can in their environment. And so I think that there is, they are providing this new opportunity that we haven't seen before.
Well, Hanna, you mentioned that we need to think about the research, and one of the challenges with this at the moment is that the technology is moving so quickly, it's hard to determine what research is appropriate to talking about this issue. And I'd like to actually talk about the American Academy of Pediatrics, who have said repeatedly that no screen time is appropriate for children under the age of 2, and that you should try to limit the amount of screen time to 2 hours a day for older children. And I'd like to take these one at a time. David, why does the AAP say that children under 2 should not have any screen time?
Yeah, I mean, it's they're really discouraging it. So it's, they have to make a recommendation based on sort of the existing information that they have. And really what they found was that there isn't evidence really for kids under 2 that they're able to learn content from screens in the way we typically think about educational content. So there a lot of the based primarily on our understanding of how educational television works and how kids learn from that type of screen. And the evidence there really isn't conclusive that the kids under 2 can learn. Kids over 2 certainly can. There's really good educational programs, really good evidence that it has a long-term impact. And so that's where this recommendation came from. And so what they are thinking about is if they're not learning, what is it replacing? Is it replacing an activity that would be developmentally more appropriate and that developmentally more enriching? So I think any new research that comes about tablets and the interactivity that they provide will be incorporated in new recommendations. It's just that we don't quite know yet what the impact will be. So they're waiting on that to make more and more recommendations.
It's interesting. I remember when 3D TVs started to become a little bit popular a couple of years ago, and the industry, you know, huddled together and came out and said, okay, no children under the age of 7 should be watching 3D TVs. And people were saying, well, what is that based on? And they were like, well, we really have no evidence that children under 7 won't be hurt by 3D TVs. It kind of feels like the same moment right now with tablets and children.
Yeah, I feel, this is Hannah speaking now, I feel like everybody has a role to play, right? So the American Academy of Pediatrics, I think, is playing their appropriate role. You know, their appropriate role is to be excessively cautious until the research rolls in, you know, but then you have parents, at the other hand, who've got these tablets, you know, their lives sort of flooded with these new things, and so they've got to make decisions kind of on the fly, right? So as a parent, you can read the AAP and think to yourself, okay, they are not going to pass or change any recommendation until the research is solidly in. We're talking 20 years. I mean, that can take a really long time, you know? So you have to make decisions, you know, just putting that as kind of one pole, and then thinking what your child wants is another pole, and then, you know, deciding somewhere in between. So that's how I think about it as a journalist.
I completely agree with that. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the AAP's also in their more recent the 2011 recommendation. You know, they recognize that parents, that media exposure is actually a reality for parents, and that they sort of are encouraging parents to engage with it and use it intentionally and actively, if they do choose to use it, instead of just making it a default activity or a background type presence.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we as parents, I don't know how many generations this will go on, but we keep pretending as if media is not natural to childhood, as if it's outside of the realm of what in our imagination constitutes a proper childhood, right? At some point, I feel like we have to give that vision up. Like, media is everywhere. I'm not saying 2-year-olds should have a TV in their bedroom. None of my children have TVs in their bedroom, and I would never do that. But technology is part of their reality from a pretty early age. And so rather than just keep pretending like it's gross, it's a lollipop, it's horrible, you know, ew, you can have it, but, you know, it's poison, just think about it a little more actively, proactively, I would say, and think about, you know, okay, so what's the best use of this? Is there something interesting? Little kids can do lots of interesting things with iPads. There's nothing wrong with what they do. They can draw. They can, you know, record their thoughts. I mean, they can play games. And I don't even think all of it has to be explicitly educational. Like, you know, the only toys I'll allow my children are ones that teach them the alphabet. It's like, you know, we don't entertain ourselves that way. There's no reason children entertain themselves. There's quality entertainment. There's, you know, quality educational materials. I mean, there's all sorts of creative ways you can think about this, but I think we have to think about it.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that young children do learn the most when they're in a free play kind of environment. And we do know that actual real-world tactile experiences are really important. But I do think you're right, that there's room for this and there's a lot of opportunity. But I agree that content that allows for that kind of exploration, even in a mediated format of the iPad, is going to be the ones that, while it might not look like education, you know, for kids that young, their play is their education.
Yeah, in European schools, what they've started to do, and we're a little behind here, but they've started to sort of use it as a tool that it's almost like journaling, you know. So the kids will go out, say, and do a nature walk and find various things, and then they record them in certain boxes in their iPads, you know, so that they just incorporate it into a tactile, sensory, regular education, which we would all be proud of and recognize as great for children, but they just use this as just another tool, you know, so the children don't think of it as this, like, magical thing that they're denied access to or have access to. It's just like another thing, like a notebook or a pen or anything like that. It just becomes normalized, which I think is an interesting route to take.
Yeah, it's really important to think of it as, you know, a system, a delivery system for content, rather than a content in and of itself. It
Right.
has so many uses and so many possibilities, and so many that can enhance education, that can enhance social interaction with parents. You know, there are games that encourage play with parents and children, or that, you know, that can enrich an environment where you're learning about something or you're experiencing something. You can download an app that gives you more information about where you are or gives you something to do about where you are. All these things are possible. So it really breaks out of the device and becomes more about access to this wide world of information and activity.
Right. I agree with that.
You're listening to Focus here on WYLL AM 580. Today we're talking about screen time, and I'm joined by Hannah Rosen, who is a senior editor at The Atlantic and Slate Magazine, and David Bickham, a research scientist at the Center on Media and Child Health and an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. So you've brought up a really interesting point, which is kind of this idea that something on the iPad does not necessarily have to be educational for a kid to make it worthwhile. I mean, Hannah, in the piece, you talk about a number of app developers who say, well, yeah, think about the toys that children really like, you know, blocks or trucks. These are not things that are teaching them the alphabet or are teaching them about teamwork necessarily. These are things that are just fun, and that's an important part of their development.
Yes, I get to that later in the story, because what I feel like another thing that parents have done now is they'll say, okay, my child can play with these things, but they have to be educational. And they define educational in a fairly narrow way, meaning learn my ABCs. So you have tons and tons and explosion of apps that teach you writing and or math apps and teach you numbers. There's nothing wrong with those apps, but I actually think that's just another symptom of our guilt about the devices. I don't actually think that's a natural place for us to land, because we do not tell our kids that they can only read textbooks at night, right? We don't ourselves only watch, you know, educational television. There's excellent entertainment, as is the apps that I am talking about, the app developers I'm talking about, I think have a really creative free play notion in building their own apps. And then there's incredibly dull, explicitly educational apps. So I think, you know, you just have to think about quality more than you're thinking about, you know, just is it educational as the only standard by which you'll judge what your children are doing on these devices.
Yeah, and it's really critical to recognize that kids that young, educational is really a different concept for kids that young. Like, they learn by playing. I mean, they also learn a lot by interacting socially with friends and family. And so that apps that allow, that encourage those things can be really, I would think, could be really effective. I mean, like I said before, we don't know yet, but it seems like if you're encouraging behaviors that we know are developmentally appropriate and enriching, then that's going to lead to positive outcomes.
I mean, these developers who, quote, the very first app they developed was called Toca Boca Tea Party. And, you know, some people might look at that and say, wow, it's incredibly dull. You know, you just put the tea plates out and then you spill some water and then you get cookies. But what the aim with the app was for kids to effectively have a tea party where they would put their own real-life stuffed animals around the app. It can be played by many, many players, and I've seen many kids play it. And the fun part is that you can spill things all the time and assign personalities to every one of your stuffed animals. So one is the one who's always making a mess and spilling things, and, you know, the other one is the one who's scolding and very neat and always washing the dishes. And so it's designed, is it educational? I don't know, you know, but are they learning things from it? Sure, there's like a lot of great social lessons and lessons about kind of contained subversion and what you can do and can't do. I mean, it's just really cool if you start to think about how it works.
I mean, I think it's important to recognize, though, that if you have a kid who's with a friend in stuffed animals and pretending to play a tea party without the iPad, I don't think they're necessarily missing out on anything by not incorporating the iPad into that experience.
Sure, of course, yes, yes. I mean, some of this, there's a concession element to it, too. Like, why can't they just go outside and have a tea party with water in the backyard and spill everything they want, you know?
Well, you can't always do that, right? So
there,
you know, when you're using this in a way that really enhances what they have access to at that moment, it can be really positive.
Like, I got so many letters from people who work in restaurants and waitresses saying it's so depressing to me to see families come in, you know, moms come in the middle of the day and they just hand their kids their phones, and, you know, and it's so depressing. Why aren't they interacting with their kids? And, you know, maybe this is controversial, I don't even know, but to me that's not depressing at all. I figure the moms have just been in the park, or they've been on a walk with their kids, or they've been interacting with them for a long, long time, and now they just want some quiet, peaceful time. So they just give the kids. Is that wrong of me? I mean, it doesn't seem like such a depressing, horrible thing to me.
I mean, I don't necessarily think so, but I think it would be a little more troubling if it was a lifestyle. Well, that was your default activity.
Right.
You know, if you take out the experience of they had just been at the park, and it's this sort of constant, you know, I'm at the park and I'm on my iPhone while that kid's playing. I'm in the restaurant and the kid's on the iPhone. Like, if you're falling into those kind of routines, and it's really becoming your go-to activity to entertain yourself or to pass the time, then I think, you know, that's unintentional use, or it's less aware use that would be something that I think, you know, you'd want to shift. You'd want to try to get parents to be more aware of how they're using it.
There's a book called Screen Time by a woman named Lisa Guernsey, which I do quote in my story, and I think she really has excellent recommendations on how you should judge whether you're on the right side of the line or not on the right side of the line. And, you know, they require you to know your own child, but one of them has to do with, you know, is your child spending too much of their time? Is this their default activity? Exactly what you just said. Well, if it is, then you have a problem. You know, it's not just something they do occasionally every once in a while. It's their default activity. And frankly, I have three different children, and each of them interact completely differently with technology, and one of them would have it as his default activity if I let him. So he has very strict limits. He sets a timer, and he knows that's it, you know, whereas the other ones don't have the same kind of limits.
Yeah, and I'm glad I saw you reference that book. That's a fantastic book. She did a lot of work really in the research field, talking to a lot of the research to write that, and a lot of, you know, a lot of times it's those pieces tend up to be more sort of opiniony, and that I think is a fantastic book for parents to turn to.
Yeah, because she systematically goes through the research. Okay, what really is the research about attention span and ADHD? What really is the research about obesity? You know, what really is the research about social classes and how they interact differently with screen time? You know, what's the difference between television and interactivity? I mean, she really takes every single issue that a parent might have rolling in their head about this stuff, and she analyzes them pretty systematically and objectively, and from that you can come to a decent conclusion about what you then want to do with your own children.
And we've actually put up a link to the book on our website, which you can find at will.illinois.edu. I'm wondering, it feels like we are in this moment where there is kind of a culture of shame around letting your kids play with an iPad. I mean, you mentioned this idea of people in restaurants saying that it seems kind of sad. I mean, I've also heard some parents who would suggest it's almost like child abuse to see other parents do this. I mean, why has this culture kind of developed?
So it's a social class thing, by the way. I mean, I think this is true of elite social classes, and it's not true of everyone else. I don't think there's that much stigma in you know, my family's working class. My brother lets his kids play with his iPad, watch TV as much as they want. So do all his friends. Nobody would ever judge him for it, except me. And so, it's, you know, there is a little bit of a social divide here. And I think the reason it is because partly our own ambivalent relationship with technology. We feel that the pull of ubiquitous technology, namely the phone in our pocket, has become incredibly strong. And so there's almost no place where we are free of it, you know, not at the dinner table, not at night, not when we first wake up in the morning. It's kind of always there. And so the idea that we are bringing our children into such an attitude in a world where technology is their right arm, I think is not that pleasant for us. We really haven't adjusted. It's all fairly new, and so we don't like it. We would like something better for them.
I also think that there's a lot of coverage of the sort of negative impacts of media that gets highlighted. You know, we talk about limits, we talk about, you know, antisocial outcomes, and we don't have these kind of conversations. We're really talking about, well, what could be, how can we harness this for positive educational impact as much as we should? And I think that this can help sort of get past some of that guilt. Because I see it. I give a lot of talks to parents, and it is the number one issue that they bring up, is just how can I deal with this? It's so clear that there's so much guilt attached to these devices.
Absolutely. There's also a culture of parenting right now around many issues, not just technology, where we feel like it's a parent's opportunity to enrich their child. I mean, this is an American idea, not a universal idea, but where we have to enrich our child in exactly the right way. So we have a sense that it's important for them to know technology and be technologically sophisticated, but in just like a precision instrument. We have to use it in just the right way, because if we don't, you know, then they'll end up in their basement playing video games with an avatar girlfriend, you know, so it's like we, or boyfriend. So we have to, you know, so it's this anxiety among parents that they have to do it just right, you know, which parents have about all sorts of things, sports, schools, you know, it's kind of an anxiety of our age.
Yeah, I think it's so important to be aware but not anxious about this, you know,
right,
to be involved but not overwhelmed, and that's an awfully difficult balance to reach.
Right.
We need to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Hannah Rosen and David Bickham here on Focus on WYLL AM 580. If you'd like to give us a call about screen time, please do so at 217-333-9455 or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet at us at Focus580. And when we come back, we'd like to hear from you. Do your kids or grandkids play with iPads or tablets, and how are they using them, and how are you monitoring their screen time? Give us a call here on Focus on WYLL. We'll be right back. You're listening to WILL AM 580. This is Focus. I'm Chris Berube, sitting in today for Jim Meadows. And joining us are a senior editor at The Atlantic, Hannah Rosen, who wrote the April cover story for the magazine called The Touchscreen Generation, talking about children and their screens. Also joining us is David Bickham, a research scientist at the Center on Media and Child Health at Children's Hospital Boston and an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. If you'd like to join our conversation about screen time, give us a call at 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Do your children have screens, and how do you monitor their screen time? We actually have an email that came in over the break. This is from Lisa in Champaign. Can you talk about screen time in teenagers? We know that teenagers are online, and with their graduation to smartphones as they get older, they seem to be online all the time everywhere. Is it important to establish screen time parameters at a young age to avoid problems later? Also, how important is it for parents to model good screen time behavior? So, Hannah or David, I'd like to hear what you have to say about that email.
Yeah, I think it's actually absolutely critical. It's very difficult to, you know, it's much easier to shape behavior early on with kids, to educate them about how to use media in a healthy way when they're very young. It's much more difficult when they're teenagers and you see a problem come up already. And you know, I don't have to reference the Pew Research, Internet research. There's some really great research that shows how often kids are using. But you know, it's pretty evident that teenagers are always on their phones and always on iPads.
I think it's a different question for little kids and teenagers, and I have a little bit of both in my family. So for little kids, you just have to be pretty direct, straightforward, and I think positive, you know, not turn it into this holy grail that they can never have access to and that they desire so greatly on the one hand, and on the other hand, as we said, not let it be the default activity for them, so land somewhere in the middle of those two. And with teenagers, I just think it's more of a constant conversation where you talk to them about things like, and here I turn to Emily Bazelon's book, Sticks and Stones, where you turn to, you know, you start to have conversations very early, and initially you tell them, I'm going to watch over you until I feel that you are using this responsibly. You talk to them about things like bullying, you know, about inappropriate context, and then you kind of let the leash go a little bit more every day.
There's some really great research in the internet safety realm that showed kids who have parents who are sort of traditionally positive parents, so authoritative parents, who are parents who are both warm but also have boundaries that they uphold, have kids who behave in safer ways online. And I think that this finding is something we can really extend to other types of media use. And I think it's really positive good news for parents, which is if you're already doing a lot of these things that traditionally are seen as positive parenting behaviors, that's going to translate into better and healthier and safer media use as well.
Right. I mean, in the same sense that you want to model kind of openness, you want a situation where your child can go to you if they wonder if something's unsafe, you know, you model good behavior so that your child enacts good behavior online. Because as I'm seeing with my preteen daughter, I mean, it really is a parallel world. I mean, I know that's an obvious thing to say. It's just, you know, coming to me for the first time, you know, it's a parallel world of friendships and relationships and connections that's, you know, very different from the real world, and where it's clear to me how things can go wrong. People can say things they don't mean. You know, things can get out of control. I mean, I completely see how that can happen really quickly.
Yeah, one point is that the sort of communication technology matches perfectly. What it provides matches perfectly for what young adolescents are doing as part of their developmental stage, which is basically moving, you know, their social focus from the family to their peers. And so these devices become much more than the sort of distracting, entertainment, educational content deliverers of young children. They become the connection to their social network. And so taking it away or at that point, or doing something that interferes with it at that point, isn't just about taking away entertainment. It's really about breaking this bond that is so important developmentally, so it becomes much, much more difficult.
Yes, and, you know, it is alien to me to watch it. It's certainly nothing like my own childhood. You know, I didn't have such things, so I did not sit around. If I wanted to you know, socialize with my friends. I had to socialize with my friends or maybe call them on the phone. So I understand, you know, as a parent, why it feels alien, you know, why my immediate reaction is that what my daughter is doing in this online world is the opposite of socializing. But then I have to take a step, that's my sort of visceral reaction, then I have to take a step back and think, well, no, it's another form of socializing, and it has its inherent dangers and pleasures, just like the old-fashioned form of socializing, but it's not inherently toxic.
Right, yep.
You're listening to Focus on WYLL AM 580, and now we're going to go to the phone lines. We have Rob from El Paso, Illinois, on the phone. Hello, Rob.
Hello.
So, Rob, what's your question for Hannah and David?
I've got a 7-year-old boy and a 4-year-old boy, and my 7-year-old this morning got up, and the first thing he did was go get on the laptop. We have 3 laptops, an iPad and an iPhone, and my wife's got a smartphone, and it seems like every time I turn around, the kids, you know, want to get on. We do not, you know, time them. They're both pretty good at it, but they do play sports and, you know, get outside, that kind of stuff. I was just looking for some advice on going forward, you know, as far as should I monitor the kids' time or limit it, you know, that kind of stuff. And I guess I'm just looking for some advice. But when my 7-year-old got this morning and the first thing he did was go get on the laptop, it kind of figured maybe I might have a problem.
That's a great question. I mean, I guess I would ask why he's on the laptop. There's a lot of you're never going to avoid a 7-year-old on a laptop, because if my children are typical, there's a lot of homework they have to do online. You know, after school,
well,
there's all these math programs. I mean, there's stuff they have to do online, so that relationship is established early. But what is he doing online?
There's a thing called Minecraft.
Oh my God!
I haven't quite grasped yet, but it's on my iPhone, my wife's Galaxy. It's on the laptops. It's on the iPad.
Believe me, I know all about Minecraft.
Okay. All right.
I was just reading Minecraft for Dummies last night to my son.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
I have a 10-year-old Minecraft addict in my house. I mean, I wouldn't let him play in the morning, but that's mine, only because he's got to get ready for school, and I want his head to be in a different place in the morning, and so he plays Minecraft in the afternoon. You know, so that's my rule in my house. But on the other hand, I do not transmit to him any sense that Minecraft is bad or evil. I just think Minecraft is awesome, and I do actually think it's awesome, which is why I read, you know, this Minecraft for Dummies book. I have to admit is fairly boring for me, but I want him to get the sense that I think it's really cool, and that this world he gets to create and sort of the things he learns in Minecraft about resources and survival and how to plan his time and, you know, how to have this ongoing project that for some kids can last for years, I think is really super cool. But that doesn't mean I let him do it whenever he wants. You know, he can do it in the afternoon when he's done with his homework and gets home from school, but not because I think it's bad. You
yeah,
know?
I think having rules like that that are based on sort of, well, what else have you done? What else have you already accomplished today? What are your other needs or things that you want to do? And can we turn to Minecraft once you sort of feel happy with where you are in all of those places? This is a really good strategy. I do think Minecraft is so engaging. You know, it is one of these things that I think can suck you in so deeply that, you know, you have to be aware of that, the amount of time that passes with that, and that being there and present for them might help that, you know, sit down and sit with them and have them describe what they're doing and talk to you about it. And that might give you some sense of, well, what is it that's pulling them in, and what is it that I can sort of, information I can give them to help them balance their use of that with everything else that they want to do in their day.
Yeah, and that's what I've done, as I said, like try to engage with Minecraft, say it's really cool. My time limits are pretty strict, but I'm not horrible. If he's in the middle of some operation that he wants to complete, I say, okay, just, you know, finish this one up and then close it down. You know, it's sort of a recognition of its enticing, addictive qualities, but also of its great and wondrous qualities and of its appropriateness kind of in the rhythm of the day.
I do think I've never played Minecraft, but I'm pretty sure that it's generally a one-player game, and so I think that the sort of massively addictive qualities of some of the other online games, where you're part of a group that sort of socially requires you to go on at certain types of times of day, can be much more sort of they can set up the danger of long play sessions or more sort of obsessive play than a game like Minecraft, where you have sort of yourself and your own goals dictate, you know, when you're on and how long you play.
Yeah, you can play with other people, but I think for the most part, people do play on their own.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Rob brings up an interesting point, though, which is that at some point it is also hard to know how much your children, how much time they're spending online, especially, you know, getting ready for this. I heard from a number of parents who had said that, you know, going to the local libraries here, that libraries here are now pushing iPads and they're pushing iPad education because it is important for kids to understand how to engage with that technology. So now that this is in the libraries and schools, it's really hard to regulate their screen time based on that. And that kind of creates another challenge. I wonder, like, is it kind of out of the hands of parents a little bit at this point?
A little bit. I'm actually annoyed that libraries do that. They've replaced library science with, you know, computer literacy. That particular thing annoys me because I feel like the library can just stay and be the library. But I think I'm on the losing side of that war. Libraries have already moved into media literacy as part of their goal, and I think that's smart of libraries because it keeps them relevant and keeps them, you know, interested to kids. I just ask my kids. I mean, they're going to the library this afternoon, and I will ask them if they, you know, what they did at the library. Did they play the screen games? Well, if they did, well, then they can't do them at home. You know, it's just a conversation. I don't think you can fight the battle with the libraries.
Well, I also think it's important for us to recognize that there's different types of media literacy. One type of media literacy sort of teaches you how to use the devices or how to seek information or things like that. And with iPads especially, they're so user-friendly. The interface and the design is so intuitive that we really don't need, you know, we don't need to teach the kids. They don't need to sit down and learn how to use this device. You know, what they need to learn is these other things that we're talking about. How do you manage your time? How do you choose, you know, content that you'll enjoy, but will also sort of be enriching to you? And those kinds of things, I think, are what libraries could really teach the kids, rather than, you know, how do you find what you want or how do you use this in a certain way.
That's absolutely true. And I asked my daughter what she's doing in media literacy because she's a real sort of bookworm, and so she's annoyed too about media literacy. But she says, but it sounds pretty good to me. What they're learning is, you know, what's a reliable source online. You know, something that they're going to have to know up until they're grown ups, and certainly well through college, that you can't just go online, look at Wikipedia, use that as fact for your term paper or whatever. You know, that's, I think, an incredibly important lesson for kids to learn now. Just kind of how do you navigate this beast? You know, how do you know what in it is reliable and trustworthy and true and what isn't? And so I think that's all important. I mean, when I was a kid, if I needed to do my history paper, what did I do? I went to the library. And so maybe libraries are just recognizing that most people are not going to do that. They're going to, you know, they're going to stay at home and look up the stuff online. And so what the libraries can do is repurpose themselves as places where you can learn how to do that online responsibly and intelligently.
You're listening to Focus on WYLL AM 580. We have Hannah Rosen, who is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and David Bickham, who is a research scientist at the Center on Media and Child Health and an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. And we are talking about screen time. Hannah, I was really interested in your article. It seems like you came up with a fairly unique solution that worked for you for kind of not weaning your kid off of screen time, but making it kind of a more healthy part of his rotation of stuff he was playing with, in that you put the iPad with his regular toys. And at first, it seemed like he was really, you know, he played with the iPad a lot every single day, but slowly kind of weaned himself off it. Like, he got bored of it the same way he might with, you know, other toys in his rotation. I mean, did you find that worked for you?
Well, I got this idea from a guy named Mark Prensky, who's a researcher, one of the people I interviewed, and he had done this with his own son. He has, I think, what most American parents would consider a radical notion, which is that his son just gets to decide. He can watch TV, he can play on his DS, he can play on the iPad. It's all just there in his toy basket with the Legos and the papers and the drawing things and anything else that the kid wants. And so because my child was young enough for me to use him as a research subject, I just thought, why not? I'll try it. You know, I'll just see what happens because I had the time. So I did put the iPad in his toy basket. I really wish other parents would do this so I would know if this is a typical response. But what happened was that he initially was really annoying about it. I mean, he would just wake up in the morning, like the caller said about Minecraft. I mean, he was, you know, 3.5 or 4, so he wasn't playing Minecraft, but he would wake up in the morning, use the iPad, you know, as I was trying to get him fed and dressed, and, you know, he would use it kind of a lot, and then he just got bored with it. He dropped it under the, you know, under the rug or under the bed and just forgot about it for several weeks at a time, which is very similar, I realize now, to what happens with many toys. You know, his next obsession was a foam U.S. puzzle, you know, which many parents would say, wow, cool, you know, how educational, but I didn't choose it for him. He became obsessed with it. He did it over and over and over again in the way that kids do that. He wouldn't play with anything else but this foam puzzle, you know, for weeks, and then And then he went on to another thing. So it was interesting to me to see that the iPad did not have an especially stronger pull than tons of other toys, you know. Now he's a little bit older, so it's a little bit different. But given that most parents are freaked out by toddlers and iPads, I wish more of them would try it. It's kind of a great solution.
Yeah, it's a really interesting experiment. I think you're right. I think there's an age window when it's kind of possible, because I do think once you have kids who know how to access the App Store and find new information,
right,
and go online and use Netflix, do all these things, it's no longer really parallel to their other toys. It sort of becomes this much broader thing. But I do think you're right, when you have a kid with a sort of, they can play with what's on it, and those games tend to be fairly limited in content. You know, there's only so much they can do. I could really see how a kid that age would tire of it fairly quickly. I have a 1.5-year-old, and he really just wants to push the button on it over and over again.
Yeah, but, stuff like that. Move the truck across the stream, push the button, talk to the talking hippo. It's a manipulative, but it's a kind of limited manipulative. You know, just
right,
as every toy is a limited manipulative, and so they do it for a while and get bored with it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Focus, and if you have a question or a comment for Hannah and David, give us a call at 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You can also send us a question on Twitter at Focus580. And I feel like it's really interesting that we've been sort of talking a bit about how, well, these games are not inherently bad necessarily, because you learn something about, you know, teamwork if you're involved in a social game or something like that. It's funny, I was reading a defense of Angry Birds online where someone was really stretching. They were saying, well, Angry Birds is great because kids learn about velocity. You know, I feel like it's really easy to overstate that argument.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the key things we don't know is how this type of learning, or what you learn from playing these games, extends into, translates into other types of understanding. Like, can you really, like if you play Angry Birds and you understand velocity, can you apply that to something else? And in general, you know, my feeling, and from what I've seen a little bit in the research, there's not a huge amount of research in this, is that in terms of that, what you're really learning is how to play that game really well. And a lot of those skills translate really well into video game play, and not necessarily into other types of, you know, broader thinking skills. But that's really going to be dependent on the game, and more research needs to be done. But it does. I do think that's something you have to think about. These claims often are made without any real evidence, just sort of based on an observation of what you're doing in the game.
It's funny because, Hannah, you mentioned in your piece an idea called the zombie effect, which the writer Jane Healy brought up. And it really does speak to this, you know, making assumptions based on our own experience and a lack of research. Because when you hear the zombie effect, the argument just being that these games make kids into zombies and they don't pay attention and they don't respond when you call their name. I mean, that's a very persuasive narrative, and it's a very familiar narrative. And it's one that's come up because we don't really have a lot of research that is specifically about interactive media.
Right, and I think we have a lot of fear about it. I mean, I don't think my daughter responds when I call her name when she's deep into a book, you know, so it's not vastly different. Or my other son, when he's, you know, building some complicated Lego tower and following closely the instructions, he's got nothing to do with me. So I think the child not responding when you call their name is not an unfamiliar phenomenon, but it is true that you hear these terms, his brain is going to mush, look at the way he's staring at the screen, and I think it's a close call whether that's concentration, intense concentration, and trying to learn something, or whether that's zoning out. But it's not always zoning out. I mean, that's what the 30 years of television research is useful for. When Sesame Street started, you know, there was a whole industry now devoted to studying how children react to television and what they learn and don't learn. And I think the conclusion is, you know, their brains don't turn to mush. They're working hard. There are better and worse programs and more age-appropriate programs, which there's tremendous amount of research on, but you can't just say their brains are turning to mush.
No, I completely agree. I think what you're seeing is the active engagement that, you know, that they're having, and that's why they're so engrossed with it. Now, they're with younger kids, there is some evidence that they have difficulty disengaging when the stimuli are as attractive as a television set. Those are for sort of infants and young infants, but once the kids are at 2 and older, they are learning how to watch TV, how to get information from TV, how to appropriately attend to what's important. All of these things are what's going on when you see that sort of deep engagement with at least with television content.
And I will say, since I do have this one child who has great difficulty disengaging, because this is something a lot of parents say, I am trying, I'm not saying I'm succeeding, but I am trying to, this is a fine line, get across the lesson that what he's doing is good and worthy, but that in his head, he should know it's of limited worthiness. It's not more worthy than everything else he does in his life. So right now, you know, we go from setting an absolute timer to giving him a little bit of a leeway if he's in the middle of a maneuver. But eventually, I want him to get that timer in his own head, to have an internal timer, because I'm not going to be there when he's 19 years old in his college dorm, you know, and all his friends are playing whatever video game kids are playing then. I want him to feel like, okay, I can do this, it's going to be fun, but I got to stop pretty quickly.
Well, we have another caller on the line. Bobby from Champaign is with us now. Bobby, we only have a few minutes left, so if you could give us a quick version of your comment, that would be great.
Great. Well, I have a couple. One is my mother was born at the end of the 19th century and was grandmother age when I was born. And although she was a voracious reader herself, when I was reading on a nice summer day, she would say, "Why don't you go outside and play?" And then with my own two youngest children, I was commuting out of town when they were adolescents, and they had an hour a day limit, except they could watch Channel 12 for free, except for Doctor Who. But they had all kinds of tricks like, "Oh, I'm not watching. This is his hour. I'm just doing my homework." And then I have one of those children has two children who are almost six and a little over three, and their other grandparents gave them iPads for their fifth and then third birthdays. And so they're a very wired family. And my daughter-in-law is a teacher, and she would do her prep when the younger child was under one, and she would, they had a divided screen, and she would put on some kind of Blue's Clues or something like that for the baby, and then she would do her homework while he was sitting on her lap. So I've seen a pretty big evolution. Just wanted to throw that in.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling in, Bobby. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. Hannah and David, what do you think?
I mean, I think that this idea of the books and like put the book down and go outside is really interesting, because it sort of reflects how we have different and sort of changing ideas about what's important for kids to do. And also, I think it captures the real reason why we talk about time limits and setting time, because we're always talking about what other opportunities are there. What is it that's being replaced by this? If you're reading, are you not being physically active? If you're, physically active, are you missing out on these other opportunities? And so I think it just goes back to, what's often said, which is you identify and work toward a balance where you're able to kind of enjoy all of these different enriching activities in your life.
And partly this is just a concession to the fact that childhood has changed pretty profoundly. I mean, many people my age, and I'm 40, will say, when I was a kid, we were outside all the time. We wandered the neighborhood, I think even if we had had iPads, they wouldn't have been that interesting to us, because we had a lot of freedom and moms were around, and it was just a slightly different world than the world we live in now, where everything is, compartmentalized into units of time, where you're taking a swim lesson or you're with a babysitter or you're doing this. It's a slightly different world that we live in. So, you feel like you have to entertain the kids sort of in chunks.
I feel like we are hitting the end of the show now. Any final thoughts? Anything that came up to you while we were having our conversation today?
Me, I just want to encourage parents. I say this every time, to just think about that poison attitude and try and change it a little bit. And find apps that you feel comfortable with, find time limits that you feel comfortable with. But in general, just to relax a little bit around this topic. Just as there are television shows that you watch and think are great and worthy, even if they're just entertaining, your children feel the same way about the technology that they use. So try and transmit that attitude to them, and I think it would be more healthy for both generations.
Yeah, I would totally echo that. I think it's engaging and being aware of the media that you're using, and enjoy it with your kids, and recognize the great positives it can have, and recognize the problems that it can have, and try to work towards the positives. I also would say, if you didn't have your question answered today, we at the Center on Media and Child also have a resource called Ask the Mediatrician, where we answer questions about media use in children's health, and it's free and available on our website, cmch.tv.
And it's a wonderful column. I've referred to it many, many times, so I would encourage parents to look at that.
And actually, David, we have 1 minute here. Hannah raised the idea of not freaking out about it. Do you think parents need to be freaked out about this, or are they sufficiently freaked out? Or
no, I mean, I think I think that being feeling guilty about this isn't a very motivating. It's not a motivating feeling. You know, you're not gonna be positive and make big change by just feeling guilty. So I would say, you know, be aware, you know, be engaged with it and enjoy it, but don't necessarily think that, oh, if I need time to be a good parent, if I need to rest in order to be a good parent, I need to have my kid take some time on the iPad and enjoy themselves. You know, there isn't evidence that that's going to have some huge major negative impact on the child.
And think of it like your own TV watching. You know, if I found myself watching 20 shows a day, I'd be really depressed. I wouldn't feel so good. But if there's a TV show I particularly love and I think it's particularly engaging and I look forward to it every week or whenever it comes on, nothing wrong with that. That's not guilty pleasure. That's just pleasure. So I think children probably experience it largely the same way.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
David Bickham is a research scientist at the Center on Media and Child Health at Children's Hospital Boston and an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Hannah Rosen is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and you could see actually her cover story from the magazine, The Touchscreen Generation, in the April issue. It's available online. And you can also hear her on the wonderful Double X Gab Fest, the podcast from Slate Magazine, which is one of my favorites. So check that out. Thank you very much for listening to Focus here on WILL AM 580. Join us again tomorrow on the show. Jim Meadows will be back with $100 billion of unfunded pension liability and millions in unpaid bills. We'll talk about what the legislature accomplished during this session in Illinois and to try to solve the state's budget woes. We'll also talk about other big issues from the session like gambling and hydraulic fracturing, concealed carry, same-sex marriage. Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky will be joining us, and Tom Kasich from the News Gazette. So that's coming up tomorrow here on Focus at the same time at noon here on WILL. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Chris Berube. Today's episode of Focus was produced by Lindsay Moon, technical direction by Jason Croft. You can find us online on Twitter at Focus580 and at will.illinois.edu. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll talk to you again next time on Focus here on WILL.